Brilliant, brilliant. I'm sorry you have to hear me whitter on all the time. I'll try and make it, you know, a little bit varied. First off, we're thinking about how God takes hold of our hand. And then I wanted to think about in this session, what does it actually look like to walk hand in hand with God? What kind, and particularly, what do we do in terms of bringing in his kingdom? Do we go on an adventure? What does that look like and what does that feel like? Because I think that the extraordinary thing about the call of the disciples and their story, if you actually just read it straight through, is how fast they end up basically kind of doing the stuff. So they know very little for most of the time, and yet Jesus engages with them and gets them to just, you know, get involved pretty much right from the get-go. So I was thinking about, I want you to, if you've got Bibles, open them at Mark 1. I'm going to take us in a whistle-stop tour of Mark. if you skip the clip one and get it onto the next slide. Perfect. Okay. So Mark 1, call of the first disciples. Then almost immediately Jesus drives out an evil spirit. So I was thinking about, how many people are on Twitter here? Do you like Twitter? Anyone on Twitter? Okay. So, you know, some people are quite annoying to follow on Twitter because they sort of do had this great coffee today and then they put a picture. You probably don't hugely care. But then other people are very interesting to follow on Twitter. So I was thinking about what it would be like to follow Peter on Twitter, had there been Twitter in, you know, first century Galilee, which, as we know, thankfully there wasn't. So, you know, first off they get called, feeling pretty good about that. Then Jesus drives out evil spirits. So Peter puts something like this on Twitter. This is fun. You know, Jesus just drove out an evil spirit. I'm trying to do it in 141 characters. This is fun. Hashtag discipleship rules. You know, right from the get-go, I have picked someone who has power and authority. This is fantastic. Then we get further on in Mark. Jesus heals many. Peter says something like, wowzers, this guy's the real deal. Hashtag, bet you're jealous. You know, it's getting really exciting. Jesus heals a man with leprosy as we go on further. This is where I really do need my glasses. 40. You'll just have to follow it with me. Literally nothing freaks him out. Bossing it. Hashtag bossing it. Do you know what hashtag is? You know what hashtags means, don't we? Just checking. I spend my life talking in hashtags. My children go, hashtag so-and-so. It's how we now have conversations. It's very strange, but you just get quite used to doing it. Anyway, this is how you'll be able to connect with teenagers. You just start going, hashtag. Literally, I'll hear you anything. Okay, Mark 2. Jesus heals a paralytic. But not only can he heal a paralytic, he also says he can forgive sins. So Peter, he can forgive sins. Unbelievable. Hashtag forgiveness. Calling of a Levi. Now, at which point we might, you know, if we're Peter, we might start to think, really? You know, fair enough calling me because, you know, at least I'm a good, at least a fisherman is nothing too contentious. But, you know, really, do you want to, you know, who are you calling? Do you want these people as well? Do you ever look around a church and think, really, God? You know, I know that you and me, we're good, but sometimes the people you put me with, maybe it's just me, you know, a bit strange, aren't they? So we begin to go there. And then Mark 3, we begin to have crowds following. You know, how amazing do you think that feels like? You know what it's like to sort of, I don't know what it's like to talk to anyone or to be famous in any way, but imagine you were sort of wandering around with David Beckham, say, as you do. And, you know, suddenly, you know, everyone is beginning to look. There is momentum gathering. This is an incredibly exciting time to be a disciple of Jesus. Now crowds are beginning to follow. And the people in your community who used to discount you because you were stupid and because you were just a fisherman, because you didn't get to the right level and you didn't actually get to be a disciple, you know, how are they feeling now? Check me out. I'm with Jesus. It's going really well. Then he's actually appointed as an apostle. So, you know, so he might say, hashtag, just call me sir. I am now an apostle of Jesus. You know, it's okay because I still will relate to all of you lesser people. But actually, I'm an apostle. So if you could just call me Sir Peter, I think that would be quite good. Jesus's own family come, and Jesus says, you know, who are my brother, who are my mothers and my brothers? So not only are we apostles, but like, I'm actually kind of part of his family now. It doesn't get any better than this. Then we go on to the parable of the sowers, which probably, frankly, they don't really understand. Then we go on to the talking about the lamp, and they're like, well, yeah, it's great. You know, it's good to get the news of the kingdom out there. Absolutely fantastic. Then we talk about growing seeds. You know, yeah, small beginnings is great. This man is so wise. Now we have the calming of the storm in which the winds and the waves actually obey him. You know, how extraordinary would that be? You know, you're in a boat. It's incredibly scary. You know, because you are a fisherman, so you know all about storms on the Sea of Galilee. And at his word, the winds and the waves quieten down. What an extraordinary thing. Awesome. Then we have the healing of another demon-possessed man. We have Jairus' daughter, who's actually dead. So now Jesus is speaking life into a child who was totally dead. And he says, Talitha, get up. And she's raised from the dead, and everyone knows about it. It's incredible. And then there's the woman who touches Jesus' cloak on the way. And we probably don't really talk about that because, you know, it's a little bit embarrassing because it was girls' problems. But, you know, she was healed simply by touching his cloak. So this is it's an incredible journey that they're going on. Then they go and they have, in Mark 6, they go back to Nazareth. And actually, that's not so good. Because, you know, the Nazarenes don't hugely accept Jesus or follow him. So it's, Jesus says, only in his hometown, amongst his relatives, and in his own house is a prophet without honor. So although they carry on doing the stuff, and bearing in mind we've now calmed the storm, raised, you know, Jairus' daughter to life, et cetera, and yet people don't actually accept it. So we might say, if we're Peter, something like, stupid Nazarenes, you know, literally, what do they know? What do they know? But the first sort of beginning to see, well, actually, you know, why didn't they go with that? And then we get to the fantastic bit where Jesus sends out the 12. And now, you know, he says this in Mark 6. So first, so we've had two bad things in Mark 6. First, we have the experience of Nazareth, where not everyone really goes with it and is very excited. And next, we hear the news that John the Baptist is beheaded. So we're beginning to think, you know, what? Now, that wasn't part of the plan. You know, this is supposed to be just a roller coaster procession through, but actually, opposition is beginning to come up. But then we have the feeding of the 5,000. Where does he send out the 12? Is it in 8? Oh, goodness me. Okay, here we go. I really, really need glasses. Yes, here we go. Yes, Mark 6, 8. These were his instructions. This is actually just before John the Baptist is beheaded. Take nothing for the journey except a staff. No bread, no bag, no money in your belts. Wear sandals, but not an extra tunic. Whenever you enter a house, stay there until you leave that town. If any place will not welcome you or not listen to you, shake the dust off your feet when you leave as a testament against them. They went out. And they preached that people should repent. They drove out many demons and anointed many sick people with oil and healed them. So there wasn't really a huge sort of discipleship training program for the disciples. They followed Jesus around. They saw some of what he did. And then pretty much from the get-go, they get sent out to do the stuff. How would you feel? You know, this is quite nice up to this point. We're watching this and we're doing this and this has happened and we're feeling quite good because we're getting quite a lot of reflected glory. So this is all very nice. Thank you very much. And then Jesus says, okay, off you go now. You know, go two by two. And, you know, this is, you know, and when opposition happens, when people don't want you, then this is what you do. And you'd be thinking, really? You know, tell me you're joking. This is a joke, right? You can't send us out because we know nothing. We know absolutely nothing. You know, we've just been hanging around with you. You know, we don't understand one end of it from the other. You're really going to send us out and you're going to send me out with him? You know, I don't mind going out with Jesus, two by two, but now I'm being sent out with another disciple who is as frankly clueless as I am. And yet they had seen the power of God at work, and they knew Jesus. And they did exactly what it said on the tin. They did that. Jesus told them to go, preach the good news, to call people to repentance, to come turn back to God, and to heal the sick, and to cast out demons. So that's exactly what they did. Not very complicated. Did they have a complex theory of deliverance? No. Had they learned a four-step program about how to pray for healing? No. Although they did use oil. Did they know anything about how to preach? Almost certainly not. So I imagine that, what they said was probably, frankly, awful. And yet, because the anointing of God is on them, and so they begin to do all the stuff. So who are the best people to evangelize? To actually evangelize other people in general? People who've got very good theology. People who have, what's the word when you... Oh, I can't even remember the word. That's why I'm not very good at doing it. People who can really get hold of contemporary topics and really apologetics, that's the word. People who are great at apologetics, great at grabbing people's attention and talking about topics of the day. Are they the best people to evangelize? What about people who are very eloquent speakers? Are they the best people to evangelize? Actually, the best people to evangelize, by and large, are people who have just got converted. They are the best evangelists. By and large, I know there's, I know we're all called to evangelize, but in terms of actually that immediate impact on other people's lives, they're the people who why does that make them the best people? Because whatever you can say about my speaking, whatever you can say about my intellect or my understanding, if my life has been transformed by meeting Jesus, you can see that. And number two, there's nothing you can say. When I say my life has been changed, to my friends, and they see a change, then it's quite unanswerable. So we have lots of fun doing a course like the Alpha course. We call it the Life course. We used to do Alpha for a long time, but we found that people were starting so much further back that we sort of changed it a bit. And, every time they turn up, they look like they're quite intimidating. The last course, we had something like 8 people from the Atheist Assembly. Now, I don't know if you've heard about the Atheist Assembly. The Atheist Assembly meet on a Sunday because they like meeting together with other people, but they don't believe in God. And so they don't think that Christians should have all the fun in terms of meeting together on a Sunday. So they meet together on a Sunday. Phenomenally successful organization. They have 43 plants, pan-globally. And anyway, for some reason, somehow we connected with them. And so they decided to all turn up on the life course, which was quite a challenge, particularly for the person leading their group, who probably didn't find it the most positive experience in the world. He comes out, everyone's like just praying for him. But, they came because they're just kind of interested. They're interested in what is portrayed. And to start off with, when you sit in a group with people, you look and you just think, what even brought you here? Why you're here? You look like you've got it together. You look like you're quite scary to me. You're not really wanting to hear it. Well, I'm coming along. I just thought I'd come along. Or my husband made me come along. Or my wife made me come along. Or a friend of mine just would not stop having a go at me. They'll sort of say those beginning things, why they're here. And then you begin to hear the stories of their lives. And actually you begin to see why they are actually here. And the most extraordinary thing, as we all know, if we've ever done, we've ever done this, you see God coming in and completely transforming them. I have a friend of mine who's now, where does he live? I don't know. But he turned up really kind of cold and highly intelligent, very successful, but sort of very, he was just very measured and quite shut, if you know what I mean. He came and did 3 life courses because he just couldn't, there was obviously something he could see in it, but he couldn't quite get what we were talking about. And so I think he might have been 2. And then he came up to me, in the week after, I don't know, week 7 of the 3rd course or something, and his face had literally changed. And he said to me, I've got something to tell you. And I was like, well, I know what you're going to tell me. You're going to tell me you've become a Christian. But I didn't say that because, it's good to give people a bit of, excitement. I was like, oh, really? No. But, his face had literally changed. And I think sometimes it's so physical. So all those people who knew him, you know, they're immediately going to be interested by what's going on because they can see a change in him. And we see how Jesus reaches in and he just lays hold of people and he transforms their lives. And it's such fun. You know, who wouldn't want to be doing that? Because you see again and again and again, of course, it actually works. Do you know, sometimes you wonder whether, I don't know whether you ever do, but sometimes you think, well, is it actually true? Well, you know, no, you don't. I know you don't. You're around looking at me going, I can't believe Carol got her to speak. But, you know, you have moments, right? And then you see the power of God on people's lives and you see the absolutely extraordinary transformation. I think this is probably more because I didn't really have it because I just kind of grew up through it. So I didn't have that really, I have a terrible conversion story. It's very uninteresting. I'm never allowed to share it on the life course. Because, you know, how exciting is it? I became a Christian when I was 8. That's pretty much it. I mean, there's obviously a lot more. But, you know, other stories are much more exciting. But anyway, I'm going off the point. But it's incredibly fun. And we, in fact, on this last course, we had a woman who was definitely not a Christian, didn't really like being with other people. She finally sort of consented to be prayed for. But it was quite a thing. And after she'd been prayed for, she could feel the Spirit on her, and she said her eyelids were fluttering, but she said, well, basically, that would be completely true, because you're just staring at me, so that was probably just a physiological reaction to, and you're being nice to me, you're putting your hands on me, so probably that's why I felt slightly peaceful. So I'm like, all right, okay. You know, and by the way, you know, I don't mind God, but what is this thing about Jesus? It's like, I don't even know, why do you even talk about Jesus? This is weird. Why would you do that? So it was a little bit of a tricky group discussion. Famously like the person who, after my husband had done a whole talk on the cross entitled, Why Did Jesus Die? We get back to the small group and this woman goes, so why did Jesus die? Anyway, obviously wasn't a very good talk. Anyway, so this woman's like, you know, yeah, okay, maybe, but definitely not a Christian. But then after she'd been prayed for, she suddenly found that she couldn't actually stop thinking about God. That she found that she actually wanted to pray, which was very strange because she'd never really prayed before in her life. So she happens to be working near this church who has an open prayer room. So she goes into this church in her lunch hour and she finds herself praying for an hour. So she's telling us all this in the group. And you know, but it actually didn't feel like enough. I wanted to pray more. She goes, and then I get back home. And I just know that if I turn on the radio, God will speak to me. So she decides she's going to turn on the radio, randomly tune the channel, and that God is going to give her a message through the radio. Now, if someone said to you, this is what I'm going to do, we'd be like, oh, no, don't do that. You know, it's not quite as simple as that. It's not a slot machine. You know, but anyway, she just, unfortunately, there are no Christians there to put her off this little scheme. So she turns on her radio, tunes in, starts listening to this song and realizes that this is basically the voice of the person who prayed for her to be filled with the Spirit at the weekend. That is playing on the radio. So she suddenly realizes, this is Hannah. This is, you know, Hannah, who the person who prayed for me. You know, and so basically it confirms. So she knew that God was going to give her a sign. And so there it is. So she turns up at the next group, completely changed. Completely transformed. Now, you know, we probably wouldn't have advised her to do it quite like that, but I can't tell you the number of times, and I'm sure you're the same, of story after story after story where God does outrageously ridiculous things to get people's attention when they're thinking about if they're going to respond to him. And it's fun to be around these people because we see the kingdom breaking in, and you see them, to start off with, it looks like they've got it all together. Then you actually see their lives and you realize they really haven't got it all together. That there have been seriously, significantly painful things going on in their lives that they have been grappling with and trying to cope with. We had, again, on the last course, someone who has felt suicidal, I think, since the age of 19. And basically, as soon as he gets prayed for, feels the whole thing lifts off him. Now, I'm not as simplistic as thinking that's all sorted out, but, you know, a massive transformation. This is someone who's now not struggling on a daily basis to try and deal with these things. But, you know, it will be part of a process, but the dramatic bit of God breaking in is amazing. And these are just random people. These are random people who've come in. Now, they are going to be the best evangelists for their friends. It is as simple as that. Do they know one end of it from the other? Absolutely not. So after the Life Course weekend, we always get them to come into church and just give us an account of what happened at the weekend. Honestly, we just sit there and like, oh, I can't believe they said that. You know, so some of them, they come out honestly with the most random stuff. The theology is frankly terrible. And they don't really know what they're talking about. But what they're trying to articulate, because of course they don't have the words that we have, is what God did, how they encounter God. And it's a bit messy. And so sometimes we worry about the fact if someone was just coming into church, you know, how would they feel about that? It sounds a bit weird or whatever it sounds like. And yet if you hear beyond the sort of the language, what you hear is stories of lives that have been completely turned around. And these are not people that would be expecting when they first turned up to be standing in front of a church full of people and telling them how God had met them and changed their life. So, you know, it's very compelling. And I think we need to, obviously, I'm not saying that we need to carry on being silly or not learn anything or not study, but actually we need to lay hold of that incredible enthusiasm which says, I know that I am changed since I took hold of Jesus. Since I took the hand of Jesus, that has been a radical and unquestionable shift in my life. And nothing is ever going to be the same again. It's going to be completely different. We're working at a different level. And I think we need to continue to have that sort of that sense of urgency, if you like. I'm not saying we should stay stupid. I'm a massive fan of theology, of training our minds, of doing apologetics, the word I've now remembered, of learning from wise women and wise men, of studying the Bible. All of that is incredibly important, and it is incredibly important to be trained and to be discipled and to be changed and to be challenged. But actually, you know, we also need to have that sort of idea that faith is quite risky, that it's okay to look stupid. You see, if you basically never believed in God, then you find yourself standing up in front of, 300 people, telling them you believe in God. You feel stupid enough anyway. So, you know, it really doesn't matter. You know, whereas we like to protect ourselves and not to feel silly and to not feel judged or whatever. Or what are they going to think about me? How's it going to look? How am I going to look? And I think we probably need to build into our lives things that we do that unless God turns up, we look pretty stupid. Does that make sense? So it's easy to be nice to someone. It is less easy to say, I think God wants to heal your shoulder. It's easy to be comforting. You know, there are some things that we can do as Christians, which if God doesn't show up, we look a little bit silly. And that's just, and I think we actually need that because then, you know, surprise, surprise, God does show up and we realize that he's actually in it with us and that this is an adventure that we can go on together. We need to dream dreams that are so big that without God, they would be utterly ridiculous. There was quite a recent study, which is on Facebook, one of these studies, about why people were leaving churches in America. And there was different reasons for different kind of groups of Christians. So the evangelicals felt they'd been misled over evolution and creation, so they're a bit annoyed. The Catholics were quite disillusioned by the clergy. But there was a huge group who simply said that it didn't do anything for them. That they don't need to be told, don't be a jerk, and act nicely to people. You know, and if that is the message that we're giving in church, when that is a, you know, where does that come from? Is that the gospel? I don't think so. Don't be a jerk and act nicely to people. You know, that's not going to set you on fire, is it? And what the researcher concluded was that people had a yearning for a more ethically engaged, prophetic Christianity. That's what people want. People need Jesus. People need to have to go on a journey in their life where they have, as we know, a relationship with the dynamic, living Son of God. And for things, people that they pray for to be changed and for situations to shift. And I think sometimes we can get disappointed and say, well, I used to be like that. Yeah, I used to feel that. But actually, then this and this happened. And so now, you know, I'm not really sure. I don't really want to put myself out there. But actually, you know, we will only see more people change by continuing to put ourselves out there. And there is no substitute for doing that. So as I was coming down, on the train, I was just thinking about this, and I was thinking about the people that I know that have the most huge number of stories about how God works in their life. So, you know, some people, like, literally, you're in a group with them, and they're just like, oh, well, yesterday. this happened and I was sitting in a sauna and da 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 da. You know, and then other people have to reach back about 15 years for a story. But, you know, so what is the difference between those two groups of people? God is God. And I think the first group probably start each day by saying, so what should we do then? You know, what should we do today? What people are you going to bring my way? You know, what can I say to them? What can I do with them? As opposed to, okay, I've got quite a lot to get through today. And, you know, I might, if you absolutely come in my face and ask me a question, I might respond. But I'm not looking for the opportunity. And I think it's people who basically feel like they're going on an adventure with Jesus every day. And I'm not trying to be simplistic. They're the people who have ongoing stories. And we have Barry Kissel, who some of you might know from New Wine. He's in our church. And he has literally continual stories. He can be in a sauna and he can have a conversation about God. He can be walking his dog and he can meet someone. And it's absolutely extraordinary. But that's partly because that's what he's looking for. So he's just kind of wandering around, you know, and he's looking for it in the people that he meets and sensing the opportunity. So as I was sitting on the train, just before I got on the train, there's a young woman. She's coming off the train that's got into the platform so I can then go off because it's at Charing Cross. And she's weeping. And I'm thinking, oh, she's just crying and crying and crying. And so I thought, well, I better go and talk to her. I'm just doing a talk after all. And so I just went up and I said, I'm really sorry. You know, tell me to go away if you want me to go away. But you seem really upset. Are you okay? And her grandmother, she was on the train to come and see her grandmother. And sadly, she'd just died. And her dad had phoned her on the train. And so she found out that the person she was coming to see had already died. And she was devastated. So I just thought, well, I'll just stay with you. I didn't want to miss my train. I was a bit worried. I kept checking. You know, I just put my arm around her and she just cried and, you know, just was talking a little bit. And then I said, well, you know what? I'm going to pray for you if that's all right. And I'm not there and then, because I should have done that, but I thought it would be a bit weird. I thought she might think it was a bit strange. But I said, she said, I'm going to go and see my dad now. And I said, you know what? I'm going to pray for you. Is that okay? And she said, that would be absolutely fantastic. Now, that's just a tiny, you know what I mean? I mean, I'm not saying that because that, and then also on the train, a homeless man sat down next to me and was really smelly. And I did nothing nice. I basically just went like this. Oh my gosh. So, you know, getting bad stories. Because I can't do smells. I just can't. I can do sad people, but smells are quite smelly. Anyway, so, I throw those two very tiny examples out as a, what is it you want to show me today? Who is it you want me to talk to? And I find, and I'm sure you're the same, but I find that when I actually pray that in the morning, I get quite a lot of opportunities to talk to people. And I spend a lot of my life, not in church, I spend a lot of it sort of doing early intervention stuff with local councils where, frankly, in the social work field, it is not very cool to be a Christian in general. As I discovered to my total detriment on the day I first signed up to do my social work training, I skip in. I've just got married to a vicar. And I'm 24 and I'd been a missionary in Uganda for a year prior to that. So we have to introduce ourselves. And I am an idiot. And I just go, well, you know, my name's Jenny. And I've just come back from Uganda being a missionary and I've just got married and my husband's a vicar and it's great to be here. And she's like, and some of those people for 2 years never ever spoke to me. Because they just thought, you're an idiot. You're exactly the sort of person we do not want to relate to. And I was just introducing myself. And one of them actually never looked me in the eye. I think she was demonized. Or she just didn't like me. But you know, so in the social work field, it is not that cool to be a Christian, generally. It's not something you necessarily really brag about. And so I have all these meetings, and I was thinking, gosh, I feel a bit schizophrenic sometimes, and I don't know if you do this, but I have my work life when I'm like this, and then I have my church life, and it's quite hard to, you know, to connect the two, because you don't want people to think you're a complete idiot, and so you've got to look, you know, have conversations or look for opportunities or whatever. So I was just thinking about that one morning as I was having a meeting with some people from Westminster. I go out and make them a cup of tea and I come back into the meeting and they literally go, so what do you believe about healing then, Jenny? And I was like, what? You know, you go to church, don't you? It's like, well, yeah. So do you believe that people are healed then? It's like, exactly how do we get into this conversation while I was making a cup of tea from early intervention and babies? And what had happened was someone had gone to a church and they'd been, I don't know, someone had, they'd heard a story of physical healing and they just thought it was the most weirdest thing they'd ever heard. And so they wanted to, but they knew I was a Christian, so they just wanted to check it out. So I'm there going, you know, I could lose my credibility with these people. Or I could lose my credibility with God. I'm definitely going to go for losing my credibility with these people because obviously, you know, I believe what I believe. And I said, you know what? I know you're going to think I'm an absolute, you know, nutter, but I actually do. I do believe in physical healing. And the reason I don't actually believe in it, I've just seen it. I've seen it too many times, the coincidence of people praying for other people and them getting healed. So, you know, I don't know what you call that. And they're all like, you know, and we just, then we carried on going back to something else. But, you know, I don't know. But it's interesting to me that the day I prayed about it, we have this random conversation. I went and did a professional training in New Zealand recently. And again, I'd sort of, because I can sort of say what I do in two different ways. I can say I'm a social worker, or I can say I will run a center based in a church, both of which are true. So it kind of depends on how I'm feeling, exactly what I say. So I'd mostly told them I was a social, oh, going to fall off the stage. I'd mostly told them I was a social worker. And I was thinking, actually, that's just not very, not that I deliberately not, but I was just trying to get a level of sort of professional acceptance, if you like. And then I thought that morning, actually, I'm not really being a witness at all. I'm just going in and doing my thing. And they don't know anything about me, really, really about me. So again, I prayed that morning, Jesus, will you just show me? Just give me an opportunity. We have coffee, and this is the X number, you know, I don't know, it was a 10-day training, so we did lots of coffee and lots of tea. And someone comes up to me and says, so where is your center base? And I said, oh, actually, it's based in the church. And we have a whole conversation about church that we would never have had. You know, and we know, don't we, the more we pray for opportunities, the more opportunities come up, and then we have to choose whether we're going to take them or not. And it's as simple as that. But we have to pray, and we have to have our eyes open to what the opportunities are. I went to hear Robbie Dawkins speak probably about 2 years ago, a New Wine Leaders thing. It was about 2 years ago. And, you know, has anyone ever heard of Robbie Dawkins? Big American, good. Amazing stories. He literally goes, if he's feeling a bit depressed, what he does is he goes to accident and emergency rooms and just prays for healing because it just makes him feel better. So, you know, if they're having a bad time, he goes, come on, let's go do the stuff. And he's enormous and in every way. He's amazing. I love him. And so I'm coming back from this conference thinking, well, I don't really do that. If I go to A&E, I'm like thinking, oh, my gosh. Just see me or see my children or do something. I am not looking for opportunities to pray for people. And so I said to God, you know, okay, give me some opportunities. I walk into this carriage at Hammersmith on the Piccadilly line and literally it's like there's a hospital outing. It's like there's people with crutches, people with arms in slings. And I say this because I did not take up this opportunity. I'm just like, not on the Piccadilly line. I can't pray for people on the Piccadilly line. I don't know why I felt the Piccadilly line was worse than any other underground line. But also, if I say to them, I'm on this train, and if I say to them, do you want me to pray for them? But they go, no, I'm just going to look like an idiot. Anyway, so I was like, I can't do it, God, I can't do it on the Piccadilly line. But then afterwards, I felt really bad. So I was like, that was pathetic, Jenny Peters. So the next people I have conversations with, I am going to offer to pray for them. And, you know, even if it's awkward, because, you know, it's kind of like, I just need to actually start doing it again. And so I happened to bump into this mum who I've been trying to get into church for ages and ages, but absolutely, I'm an atheist, stay away, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I happened to bump into her in Marks and Spencer's, as you do. And I was talking to her, and I can't remember what she was talking about. It might have been her dad. Who wasn't very well. And I said, you know, this is going to sound really weird, because bear in mind, she wanted nothing to do with church. I was like, rats, I'm going to have to start with her. You know, but actually, I do believe in healing. So I'm going to pray for them, and we'll just see what happens. And she goes, that's really interesting. And I said, why? She said, well, actually, my mum has just become a Christian. And she said, I don't really understand it. I think I might start coming to your church. Now, this was someone, she actually hasn't yet. I say that because not all stories are complete. It would have been nice had she come in. But, you know, it was, and I just dropped it into the conversation. And it wasn't that complicated, and it wasn't as threatening as, you know, so I think we all have our level. Robbie Dawkins probably would absolutely love to pray for everyone on the Piccadilly line. Whereas I decided, well, this is my level. I'm going to try and take the opportunities. Because some people are really brave and some people aren't really brave. And I think we have to be realistic with the person that we are. But we do have to be doing things that we will look stupid if God doesn't turn up. And I think that is true for whatever kind of person we are and whatever kind of situation we're in. I think the disciples would have definitely preferred to keep on going around with Jesus. I think the disciples, if they were given the choice, would never have left his side. I think they wouldn't have wanted to go out two by two and go and do mission. I think it was probably terrifying. I think for all the stories of healing, they probably had some disastrous times, and they definitely would have had times, because Jesus warned them about it, where they weren't welcomed in anywhere and they were hounded out of a village. And I think sometimes I can find myself sort of imagining that I could be deeply used by God if I wasn't in this current situation. So I'm in this season and, you know, oh, it's just really difficult. You know, well, I know God could use me, but, you know, maybe, you know, God will use me when. And we work with a lot of young people, and a lot of people get fixated on the idea that God can use me when I'm married, or when I've worked out what my calling is, or when I've got a settled job, or when I don't have to study if I'm a student, or when I don't have small children, or when I don't have teenage children, or, you know, when. And we can get so stuck in looking either backwards or forwards. Oh, God really did that then. That was amazing. That was amazing a while ago. Or it might be great in the future, and just miss all the opportunities in the season that we're in. You know, and all the seasons are just, they're different and they have different opportunities. We've helped plant some churches over about the last 10 years. And so as part of what we do, we get to go and visit the churches. So they're all randomly in different places in the world. And the first one we did was in New Zealand. And so we go in and we talk to the church leaders. And every single church leader will tell you what is difficult about their context. So they might say, well, you know, just, you know, so if you're in New Zealand, well, not many people go to church. People just think Christians are a bit idiotic. We've actually also planted a church in Florida. It's a long story. And they will go, well, just so many people go to church. It's a nightmare. And you're just thinking, how can that be a nightmare? That would be great. But I honestly think that everyone genuinely believes that their context is uniquely difficult. And I would definitely say of doing church in central London is very tough. Because you know what? People are always leaving. And relationally, it is very costly. And, you know, because people can't afford to live in central London for much longer, so they move out. And so you have them for a while, and then off they go. And then you don't see them again. And if you're not careful, you become the kind of person who slightly disengages with people because you're just waiting for them to go. So it feels like you convert them, you help them, then off they go and have an adventure somewhere else. Thanks very much. Here I am, still here. So I would tell you that doing church in central London is really tough. On the other hand, doing church in central London means you always get new people coming into your building pretty much every week. Now, how amazing is that? So it has, you know, it has challenges and it has huge strengths. And I think that's probably true of every season of our life. It has challenges and it has huge opportunities. So when you have small children, life becomes completely chaotic. You know, the ordered, nice, systematic sort of spirituality that we might have had before we had children just, you know, blows up in our face. I remember someone saying, well, when do you have your quiet time? Do you get up before the children? My children get up at 6 o'clock. No, I do not get up before my children. Well, when do you have your hours quiet time? I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to lie. Well, sort of through the day. You know, and you know, the answer is you have to learn to do spirituality different, actually, when you have small kids. And you do have to do it through the day. And there are lots of ways you can do it, and there are lots of ways you can still engage with God. But it doesn't look the same. You often don't get into a whole service. You might not hear a whole talk because, your baby won't be left. Anyway, you've got baby brain, so you can't even focus on what's being said. And yet, you know, there are huge insights into the Word of God that you would never have had if you hadn't had children. And also, you have this incredible opportunity in terms of meeting people. You know, so you suddenly start meeting people in, you know, antenatal, baby weigh-in, drop-ins. There's this whole world that kind of opens up. And so it's a whole different sort of experience. Michael Green. Has anyone ever heard of Michael Green, who's the rector of St. Aldate's? You know, all my people. And he was a massive, you know, he's just a serious evangelist. And he had to have a heart operation. I think he was about 80 at this time. So we might say, you know, gosh, I'm actually quite seriously ill. I'm quite worried. What I need is, I need God's peace to come, and I need him to heal me, and I'm just not going to worry about everyone else around me. But because he's an animal when it comes to evangelism, he just spent the entire time going around the ward praying for people. Now, you know, if he can do it when he's about to have a serious heart operation at 80, we can do it whatever situation we're in. You know, it's almost like, I'm not saying that we have to feel guilty and go and do it all the time, but I don't think we should discount the season and say, well, if only I wasn't doing this. If only I wasn't caring for an elderly mother or doing this, or children were going through this, or having a tough time at work or doing this. It's, you know, actually, we get opportunities throughout our lives and throughout our days that we should be meeting. So this picture here is in an organization called Harvest India. If you can just put the next one up. And they basically, it's, can't quite remember where in India it is because I haven't visited it, but a friend of mine has just got back from there. It's near, you have to fly into Hyderabad and then you have to go for about 7 hours. But they run this incredible project. All over, I mean, they've planted hundreds of churches, and they would say that the powerhouse, the spiritual sort of engine of Harvest India, is some of these women who are 80 and 90, and they meet daily and they pray. So they're in a home, they need to be looked after, but you know what? You can pray. So, you know, and that's what, and actually that enables their whole ministry to actually function. So I think that probably there's no situation, and I'm not saying that God doesn't care about our situations. Of course he does. I'm not saying God doesn't have compassion over us. He absolutely does. You know, and there are times when simply carrying on is all we can manage because life is very tough. And God has huge compassion on that. But I also think we are designed to be making a difference in our world. That's actually better for us. And it doesn't really matter what it looks like. You might rather die than pray for someone for healing. But it doesn't matter what it looks like. But we do need to be doing things where we see God turn up, where we know that we couldn't have done it on our own, and we see God turn up, and we see how that makes a difference in our context. Because that's what we're made for. And that's what gives us life. And, you know, it's an adventure. I think the other thing, just as I was thinking about it, that can stop us is we can try and be perfect. So I talked about it a little bit before. But we need to avoid comparison. I think comparison is deadly. I think women are particularly bad at this. I'm not talking particularly about women in leadership, but in our experience of women in leadership, the most negative, critical, and frankly bitchy people to other women who are leading and speaking are women. It's generally not the men. We ran this course called the One Course, which is all about relationships. And there was a relatively young, she must have been about 25 at the time, person on our staff team, absolutely brilliant, very gifted, really nice, bubbly, blah, 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 blah. So she compared it all. And then we get some sort of feedback forms coming back in. And there was one form that was vitriolic in its hatred of her by a woman. And I think the reason was because she was given a role that this person actually wanted. But it was really nasty. And the good thing for them was that it was anonymous, so no one knew who it was. Otherwise, you know, I would have personally become very, very annoyed with her because it was just so horrible. And I think we're very bad at comparison. And it can really stop us doing stuff for God. Either in the way of, you know, they're so amazing. I just could never do that. I couldn't stand up there and I couldn't do that, or I couldn't do this. Or, you know, or why did they have a position to do that and why don't I? You know, and any kind of comparison can stop us from really being used by God. Or thinking that everyone else has got it together. Facebook, I think, is actually very unhelpful. Who's on Facebook? Okay, so on Facebook, we can control the image that we portray, okay? So we can put nice pictures, shiny, happy pictures, smiling pictures, pictures of our holidays, pictures of us when our children are talking to us, pictures of us when we're talking to our husbands. So I was giving a talk in church last summer, and we, as it happened, we'd gone to the beach. And so I put this nice picture up of the whole family on the beach, you know, smiley. The night before we'd gone to the beach, we had the worst family argument we have ever had in our entire existence, in which I am standing in the living room weeping because my children are being so horrible. And everyone is yelling, everyone is screaming, and most of us are crying. And the next day we go to the beach. Now, I do not put the picture up of everyone yelling and screaming on Facebook. I put the nice, happy, skippy picture of the beach. And if we're not careful, we can believe the lie that we portray to other people. So I was talking about this in church, and I said, you know, actually, I showed them the picture. And, you know, the night before, this is actually what happened. And I can't tell you how many conversations I've had on the back of that. I can't believe you have arguments too. Really? You know, and actually, we ended up having a season where we sort of tried to help a lot of people in their relationships because it was their relationships were messy. And I'd given them an insight into that it might actually be possible to have a messy relationship and be open about it and have a fight and it to be okay. You know, and I find that quite depressing because it's obvious, right? I used to live with the Gumbels. I don't know if I can say this. You might have to delete this bit afterwards. And so I used to live in a flat above their house. So Nicky Gumbel is an amazing, amazing evangelist and a fantastically lovely man. And they used to have terrible arguments going to church with their three children. You know, Henry, where are... No, you cannot take a cricket bat to church, Henry. And I used to be lying in bed thinking, oh, this is terrible. You know, and then you start having children. You have exact... Well, I mean, we used to have football conversations, not cricket bats. But, you know, exactly the same. You know, going to church is some of the worst times of the week, and everyone turns up in church and then they have to go, hi! You know, new wine, even worse. But, you know, most people have had an argument with their children on the way to church. I absolutely bet you. Well, maybe not. But I reckon most people have, and all their spouse. So then that's how we turn up. But we don't say that to everyone. How are you? Fine. Yeah, fine. Thanks. Yeah, how are you? You know, and so it perpetuates the lie that we have to look perfect, think perfect, and be perfect to be used by God, to be a proper Christian, to do all this kind of stuff. And it's a lie, and it really, really stops us. And one of my favorite authors at the moment is someone called Brené Brown, who's written a book called The Gifts of Imperfection. And this is what she says about perfectionism. Perfectionism is not the same thing as striving to be your best. Perfectionism is not about healthy achievement and growth. Perfectionism is the belief that if we live perfect, look perfect, and act perfect, we can minimize or avoid the pain of blame, judgment, and shame. It's a shield. Perfectionism is a 20-ton shield that we lug around thinking it will protect us, when in fact, it's the thing that really prevents us from taking flight. We weren't picked to be... Jesus didn't take hold of our hand because we were perfect. So we just need to let go. You can't hold the hand of God and the hand of others and hold on to perfectionism. It just doesn't work. So we have to choose to let that go. And that means sometimes we feel shame. Sometimes we feel blame. Sometimes we have to be vulnerable and get other people thinking, I can't believe it. But that's what we have to do if we actually really want to be used by God. See, I never think Peter is a perfectionist. I think if he'd been a perfectionist, he would have imploded. Because he messed it up so many times, so spectacularly. And this is when we have a different experience. We have the Spirit of God that is available to us. You know, we have, and it's extraordinary. You know, we have the power of God available to us. So when I put my hand on someone and pray for them, I'm not having to dredge it up from my own experience or my own professionalism or my own niceness. My sole responsibility is to say, let's pray. Because you know what? I can't do it. I can't have a word of prophecy for you. I can have a word of knowledge for you. I have no idea. I can't pray for you for healing. I cannot heal you. I cannot do anything. But I have access to someone who can. So I'm going to be trying to be used in the process. You know, the people who are the most effective in terms of ministry are the people who pray the most. It's really straightforward. The people who are, you know, and quite often you'll see people coming up to the front time and time and time and time and time again, You know, my husband, when he first got converted, he was 19, he was in St. Aldate's, and he would come up and he would turn up in church, start crying, cry for an hour and a half, and leave. And he did that for a year. I mean, you'd think he was a bit of a weirdo, actually. He was a bit of a weirdo, but, you know. And yet, that was the thing that healed him. You know, and then, so he knew then that it was nothing to do with him. And he loves praying for people. And the thing is, the more you do it, the more you see God work. And so the more it encourages us. Or whatever it is. It could be a justice ministry. It could be going out on the streets. It could be doing anything. But we have to be doing stuff that if God doesn't turn up, we look stupid. Amen.